The title of this lecture may be overly generic, and I hope this isn't false advertising. Talk about the American Austrians. You may have been expecting me to talk about Murray Rothbard or some of the more prominent later Austrians later in the 20th century. But what I plan to talk about actually are some of the early American Austrians. The justification for doing this is that it raises a very interesting a question for us all in terms of the Austrian movement, which is if we can demonstrate that we had Austrian thinkers early in the 20th century, American Austrian thinkers, that in other words the Austrian school wasn't limited just to Vienna, but that there were important guys here in America doing this kind of work, why was there no movement? Why didn't it get off the ground here? What held it down or supplanted it? And so that's the sort of question I think that we can pursue by thinking about these early Austrians. And the three guys that I've selected are Frank Fetter. Frank Fetter, I would argue, was not only an Austrian economist, but I would say in the first half of the 20th century, he was one of the leading Mengerian economists in the whole world. He was much more a pure Austrian thinker in economics than many prominent economists in Vienna. So Frank Fetter is our example of high theory. And there were other high theorists, Davenport and so on, in this period, J.B. Clark to some extent. Then Henry Hazlitt, we want to talk a little bit about Hazlitt as the public intellectual. Again, we had a very important public intellectual who was a hardcore Austrian. Again, why didn't this make a dent in public opinion? Then there was a Benjamin Anderson, and Benjamin Anderson was a practitioner, and he worked on Wall Street for big Wall Street banks, and was a very strong and steady proponent of Mises' theory of the business cycle. And so again, they had this kind of prominent practitioner pushing the Mises business cycle theory all through the Great Depression. He wrote his great book published in 1949. Giving his analysis of the Great Depression. And so you may recall that Rothbard himself says that these three elements, high theory, the public intellectual, the practitioner, are the three arms of a strategic movement, of an intellectual movement. Right? You have to have all of this, right? You have to have the high theory, you have to be able to bring this theory to the public, you have to be public intellectuals who can convince people, the critical mass of people, that this is correct, and then practitioners who are putting this into practice, demonstrating its value in the real world. So this entire set was in place. What was lacking, though, I would say, is institutional support. Joe Salerno has written a great article about this where he shows that any intellectual movement has to also have private property, right? You have to have institutionalized entrepreneurs who devote their private property to the movement. You have to have independent universities who will devote themselves to this view, and therefore be a magnet to draw young scholars to this position. You have to have institutes like the Mises Institute. And so on, and none of that existed. There were certain. Again, there was Fetter, for example, who was at Princeton, but Fetter was never a movement guy. He never tried to draw students. He was a great lecturer and a very popular teacher, but he never took it as his role to build a movement. And so, Princeton didn't support him in this sense. He made nothing of this post. This, by the way, you may recall also reading in some Rothbard about Vienna. this was what Rothbard considered the great mistake of the Viennese Austrians, Menger in particular, that they didn't promote their own like-minded scholars. They, you know, when an opening came up to teach economics in Vienna, Menger would fill it with someone who was opposed to his views, or you know, not fully supportive of his views. And Rothbard always thought that this was a great mistake. You know, you have to have these intellectual beachheads, right, where private property is seized, so to speak, or you know, comes under the control of, or is given over to the intellectuals who propagate these views, and then they have to recognize that they're to use this property to advance the movement. And this is the sort of thing, even though we had the intellectual pieces of the puzzle in place, we didn't have the institutional pieces of the puzzle. Okay, we might also point out that this was true. This was also true about Rothbard himself and Mises as well, because both Rothbard and Mises played all three of these roles, right? They were high theorists. This is indisputable. They were also public intellectuals. This is obvious with Rothbard, you know, all of his popular articles and so on. But we found, although this wasn't common knowledge for those of us who work in this area, this was also true of Mises. In the Mises archive in Moscow that has been mentioned a few times during the week. In that archive, the main bulk of it are popular articles that Mises wrote. He was a media star in Vienna. He was like the go-to guy when the media wanted to know something about economics, right? The newspapers and so on. They would go to Mises and interview him. So he was a public intellectual. He fulfilled this role. And of course, they were both practitioners. They were both practitioners, at least in the sense of policy. So Rothbard was an advisor to Taft, to Buchanan later on. You know, he wrote prolifically about policy questions, was involved in political movements and so on. But Mises, too, of course, he worked for his job in Vienna was with the Chamber of Commerce, 1912 to 1934. In this position, what he did was to turn out policy studies, right? He was basically an applied economist during this period. I mean, is his full-time job. He started the Austrian Institute for Business Cycle Research in 1926, made Hayek the director. Right? This was nothing but practical things, right? Applied economics, you know, explaining the business cycle, doing research, and so on. So Mises was heavily involved in this. Okay, now let's turn to these three economists. The first is Frank Fetter. Fetter was born in a little town in Indiana in 1863, and he passed away in 1949. He got his bachelor's degree in Indiana University, and then he went. This was in 1891, and then the next year he went to Cornell to get his master's degree. He was a very bright student, very gifted intellectual. As I'll mention in a minute, he went to Germany and he got his PhD in Germany and wrote his dissertation in German. You know, that's rather remarkable. I mean, the powers of his intellect were tremendous. Anyway, at Cornell, he met Jeremiah Jenks. Jenks was a big shot a professor at Cornell. He was very involved in the progressive movement, and Fetter got, Jenks recognized his potential and drew him into this movement. That's why he sent him to Germany. He sent him to a German PhD to get trained in the kind of social engineering, this kind of Bismarckian social engineering mindset. So Fetter got his master's degree from Cornell in 92, went on then to Germany. He did his PhD and finished in 1894 at the University of Halle. He wrote his dissertation, as I mentioned, in German on population theory. This was a very popular topic at the time for economists to write in. While he was in Europe, he studied at the Sorbonne. He met Bumbavork. He undoubtedly attended Bumbavork's seminar, even though when I researched Fetter, I couldn't find any actual evidence that he did this, but more than likely he did. He was in Vienna, and you know, he knew Bumbavork, they corresponded, and so on. So he came in contact directly with the Austrians during this period. His training was not Austrian, right? He wasn't taking classes from Menger or some such thing. Now, he came back to the United States then, had taught for a year at Cornell, went to Indiana University until about 1898, and then he took a job at Stanford and probably would have stayed at Stanford, but he got involved in a controversy with a colleague of his who was fired without cause, according to Fetter, and Fetter simply quit, which indicates that he also had tremendous character, right? This was not the sort of thing that you would do lightly. You finally get the big position, right, at Stanford, and then you quit after 3 years just because you want to show solidarity with your friend who was dismissed. Of course, it helped that he could go back to Cornell. You know, it helped that he had Jenks at Cornell. So he went back to Cornell for 10 years, and then in 1911 he took the post for which we know him most famously at Princeton, and became chairman of the Department of Economics at Princeton. So he was at Princeton from 1911 to 1933. He was forced into retirement. They had a forced retirement age at 65. He's forced into retirement. And yet he was such a popular lecturer that that Princeton hired him back. You know, they fired him, got rid of him, and then hired him back kind of part time, and he continued to teach for about five till he was his early 70s. He was a visiting professor at Harvard, Columbia, Johns Hopkins, Northwestern, the Claremont Colleges. He was an officer and president of the American Economic Association. He published 8 books. 100 scholarly articles, many of these in the top journals, the AER, QJE, JPE. He did over 50 book reviews. He delivered a dozen major addresses. He testified before Congress and federal agencies several times. He was a big shot. He was a big shot, right? He's a hardcore Austrian in theory. Now, this also, by the way, I want to run through what his theories were. I want to sort of demonstrate this, but we do that, let me just mention that it seems like an odd thing. Why would he be so accepted? What was behind this? How could he be such a big shot in the economics profession when the economics profession by this time, by the 20s and 30s, is certainly moving away from Austrian ideas? And the answer here is this social engineering, this sort of progressive notion, program. While Fetter never really fully bought into this, he was sort of directed by the people around him to do work in this area. And so he became, I mentioned he testified before Congress, he became fairly well known for doing work in monopoly theory, applied work in monopoly theory. The Pittsburgh Pittsburgh-based price systems of the railroads and things like this, and he was a big shot in this, and that's what called him to Congress, and he was testifying against big businesses engaged in certain practices which were considered monopolistic, and he wrote a book on this called The Masquerade of Monopoly. So his prestige was due to the fact that he was not a hardcore laissez-faireist. He was willing. He was in certain respects, but not in that respect. He thought antitrust was a good idea. He thought, certain interventions were acceptable and justifiable. This also, by the way, calls to mind the question of the compatibility of these different views, right? The compatibility of economic theory and your political philosophy. Is it really strictly true that from Austrian theory one can only spin out laissez-faire conclusions, or is something else going on here? Right? Fetter is sort of conflicted here about this, or he shows that there can be a conflict. Okay, so now let's run just through his bona fides as an Austrian scholar. My guess is that if most of you know anything about Fetter, it's his. The book that Rothbard put together of his articles on capital and interest. You probably have read that book or read excerpts of that book. And so this is what we know Fetter best for, is his work on a series of articles that he started to publish in the late 19th century and then into the 1920s and 30s on capital and interest. And here Fetter did pioneering work. He perfected Bumbavork's theory of capital and interest, purging it of all productivity elements. Remember, Bumbavork sort of brought productivity elements back into interest theory through the back door. And Fetter washed all this away. He showed what the Misesian position would be later on this. He also created a general theory of rental pricing for factors of production, showing that every factor of production will be paid a rent for the service of the factor, say the wage for an hour of labor, the rental price for a capital good or for an acre of land, and so on. That all these prices are determined in exactly the same way by the marginal revenue product of the factor of production. The entrepreneur estimates what he thinks the extra revenue will be by employing this factor, and then discounts that by the rate of interest. He also argued that this discount is independent of productivity factors. Right? The discount he argued had to be determined by the entrepreneur. He had to be able to estimate it in his mind before he discounts. Right? He has to be able to say, "Oh, I think it's 5% is the discount I should place upon this." A purchase that I make. So he can't use productivity elements to determine the rate of discount. This has to be an independent thing, Fetter thought. And of course, that led him then to the theory of time preference as an explanation. He's following Bumbavork here, obviously, but he thought that was correct, that time preference must be the explanation, the sole explanation for interest. And so it was really Fetter who gave us this theory that is adopted later by both by Mises and Rothbard, that we have something like a time market, and the time market is the total sum of all present money exchanged for future money, and that this is done on the basis of reverse preferences that people have for present money and future money, reverse ranking orders of time preference. Some are low and some have high time preference. So they exchange just like in any market, and the interest rate emerges from this exchange. And so we get a completely subjective value theory of interest here, right? Interest is just determined by people's judgments of the value of present satisfactions relative to future. And then he went further to point out that the time market then is divisible into the credit markets, where we have a credit transaction, a loan contract, and then the structure of production. Productive processes where the entrepreneur lends to the workers, paying them in advance of the sale of the good and the recouping of revenues. Fetter also thought, he tended to argue about economics from what he called the nature of man. So he was an axiomatic thinker. I'll give you a few quotes on this in a minute, but he thought time preference was just part of the nature of the world. He thought it followed directly from the scarcity of present gratifications. He thought time preference must exist as long as scarcity exists in the world. He also recognized, and here again he's just following Bumbavork, that time preference, by implying capitalization, time preference in other words implies that the value of future revenues are discounted when paid in the present. That this is the answer to the Marxian theory of exploitation, right? That the entrepreneur exploits the worker by paying a wage to the worker that's lower than the value of what's produced. You know, Bumbavork pointed out, well, yes, the entrepreneur does pay a wage today that's lower than the eventual future value of what's produced, but the difference is based upon discount. Right, because the entrepreneur is lending money to these workers today. If the workers want to wait to get paid until the output's sold, then there would be no discount and they'd get the full marginal revenue product. So Fetter is repeating this, right? Repeating this insight of Bumbavork. And then the last thing here on capital and interest, Fetter showed that in advance of Keynes's theories that would come along later, which argued that interest is a monetary phenomenon. Remember, Keynes argued that interest is determined by liquidity preference, by demand for money and the money stock. Federer sort of laid out in advance a refutation of this. He said, no, this can't be right. Interest can't be a solely monetary phenomenon. It's determined by time preference, right, by our subjective values. It doesn't have anything to do, per se, with money. Okay, now, the book that Federer wrote, where he laid out his a fuller view, remember what we've been talking about are just these articles that were collected into the book Capital and Interest later on by Rothbard. But Federer's first work, where he laid out his general view of things, was The Principles of Economics, which he first published in 1904. It's very hard to get a copy of this book because Federer, in 1915, published a new edition where he split the book. He actually added a whole bunch of chapters to it, and so he split it into two parts. And the Mises Library has a couple copies of the 1915 edition, which is different. So the 1915 edition, what was in the 1904 edition, is pretty much the first volume. And the second volume is devoted to all these things that we spoke about before, where Federer's getting involved in talking about antitrust and government intervention. So he goes through his theories of basically of state intervention. And here he's not so good, right? We've already commented on he's not certainly a Misesian on those questions. But in his 1904 book, he really took up the project that Mises himself would complete in 1912, which was to provide a general theory of value based on the marginalist revolution. He really sort of explicitly saw this as the task at hand. And so this is one of the reasons why he put the time preference explanation, made it purely subjective. Well, he thought to explain the rate of interest, we have to have a purely subjective theory. But he tried to do this also for other elements of economic theory. He did this for the prices of goods. He did this for, or attempted to even do this for money, although he didn't achieve what Mises would later on. Now, as I mentioned before, he had an axiomatic deductive method. Let me give you a few quotes from his book. He said, in economics, we, quote, proceed by gradual steps, as in a series of geometrical propositions, from the simple and familiar acts and experiences of the individual's everyday life, through the more complex relations to the most complex practical economic problems of the day. So it's just this kind of deductively spinning out, adding complications as we go. We start with the very basic things, just what is action and so on, and then we just branch out from there. In another place he says economics begins with the, quote, simple and almost self-evident proposition that the motive force in economics is found in the feelings of men. It's purely subjective, right? It's found in our tastes and preferences and so on. And then in one last place he says, quote, in studying the problem of value, one must recognize any motive that leads men to attach importance to acts and things. This is a very subjective beginning point. So he goes on in the book to show how prices of goods are determined by the law of diminishing marginal utility, pretty much as we set out earlier in the week. He thought that this too was built into the nature of man. He thought this was just the nature of the case that as a person added a unit of a stock of a good, its marginal utility would fall. So that he derived both demand and supply from this law. And so he had a thoroughly subjective theory. He didn't have a cost of production plus subjective value theory. He thought these prices that were being explained by the theory were real prices and not hypothetical. Again, this is in straight Mengerian Boombawork's view, what Mises would produce later in Human Action. He even adopted Boombawork's presentation of this. He said, the price of a good, once we see the price emerge in the market, we can imply that that price reflects the valuations of the marginal pairs of traders. Remember, he uses that same phrase that you find in Boombawork. Okay, on factor prices, he thought the important principle was the law of decreasing returns. Again, this is straight out of Rothbard. You can find this analysis. As the stock of a factor that's used in cooperation with complementary factors is increased, the additional productivity diminishes. And in fact, here, Fetter again made a contribution to economic theory by pointing out that this particular case, you know, let's say we have an entrepreneur and he has a production facility, a certain fixed capital capacity, as a factory and so on, and he adds more and more labor to it, and so eventually the additional output he gets through this exercise diminishes. Fetter shows that this is actually just a special case of a much more general principle that he considered to be, in fact, axiomatic, which he called the law of proportionality. And he defines the law of proportionality this way. He says, quote, "It's the fundamental axiomatic truth that there is a best or proper adjustment of means and ends in a man's action." Remember, and this is how Rothbard presents the idea in Man, Economy, and State. He says, you know, if we consider this special case, the entrepreneur with a factory, and he's adding, you know, fixed, he has a fixed factors, and he's adding more and more variable factor to it, then the average physical product of the variable factor will rise, hit a maximum, and then fall. In other words, he says there's an optimal combination, right? There's a best, in terms of the physical productivity, there's a best, one best combination of the factors of production to meet the end. And this is the maximum of APP, of the average physical product. And if you move the amount of the factor either greater or lesser from that amount, you get reduced productivity. Right? This is the idea of the law of proportionality. Okay, so he goes directly then from this idea of diminishing physical productivity to diminishing marginal revenue product, right? He's trying to construct the demand curve for factors of production. And then he also has this Rothbardian, Rothbard gets this from him. Rothbard also has a presentation of the same thing that you find in Fetter, which is different to, if you think about the whole economy and marginal revenue products for a particular type of factor across the whole economy, then, of course, the economizing way in which to allocate this factor is that you should allocate the first unit of the factor to the highest marginal revenue product use. And then you should allocate the next unit of the factor to the next highest marginal revenue product use, right? And then so on and so forth. Let's say you have farmland, arable land, and let's say the most valuable use is in wheat or something. And so, you know, you put a certain number of acres into wheat. And then if there are other valuable uses to which it could be put, then you would reserve the marginal units for those things. The same with labor. So you would allocate it. You'd want it allocated in this way. And Fetter shows that this process occurs, so to speak, automatically on the market, because entrepreneurs who are producing where these marginal revenue products are high can outbid the entrepreneurs who would be producing where the marginal revenue products are low. So it's just through the competitive bidding process that the factor always gets allocated into its highest marginal revenue product uses. And then in any particular production process, if the marginal revenue product for the factor is above the price, if it's we still have a gap here, then that entrepreneur will extend his use until he'll earn profit by extending his use until it's roughly equal at the margin, right? So he's hiring more and more workers to exploit this greater value that they're producing in his business as opposed to other businesses. And so he's, by paying higher wages, he's drawing out these workers, or paying higher prices for capital, whatever it might be. He's drawing these factors of production to his own business. And so Fetter has this analysis too, how factors are allocated according to their marginal revenue product within a business and across all businesses. So it's a pretty complete theory. And then one last thing, just on the standard kind of analysis here, he also points out that not surprisingly, that it's not really the marginal revenue product; it's a discounted marginal revenue product. This could be important, of course, because you could have different time horizons, different periods of production, and different production processes. So it may be that you employ a factor of production, but there's a 2-year production process to get the output. Somebody else is employing the factor, but there's only a 6-month production process, and the discounting then would be different, right? So when you apply the discount to these marginal revenue products, you can get different results. It isn't just that you proportionally lower all marginal revenue products. You might get a disparate result. And so you have to account for the, you have to say in the theory that it's the discounted marginal revenue product. It's simply a mistake to leave it at the marginal revenue product. Then one last thing he does here is a anachronism, something that you wouldn't find in a modern a treatment of these questions, where he has a section where he talks about differentials in rent. This is a throwback to Ricardo. I remember how Ricardo talked about rent being a differential between sort of the basic least, valuable use that's in use and the more valuable ones. So the rent is the difference between the highest marginal revenue product and the lowest, let's say, or between any particular marginal revenue product and the lowest one in use. And Fetter wants to say something about this, and I'm not really sure why he's still concerned with this Ricardian theory, but anyway, he says any differentials that we find would be analogous to differentials in prices that we find for consumer goods. Why, for example, is the price of some ice cream higher than the price of others? Let's say it's vanilla ice cream. And the answer is, well, it's of greater quality, right? Some ice cream is just of greater quality, or they're just a differential in preference for it, or something like this. So these differences in marginal revenue products, rental spaces, that as Ricardo would call them, are just determined not, as Ricardo thought, by differentials, some kind of a differential theory, but they're just determined in the same way that differences in prices of consumer goods are determined. They're determined by differences in quality, differences in productivity that are unique to this person or this particular plot of land, and so on. So there's no difficulty for the theory here. We just have to recognize that we have a complexity in the real world because different particular farms will have different productivity, and therefore one would command a higher rental rate than the one just near to it, even though they're growing the same product. Okay, then the last thing on price theory, he also has the correct theory, the Austrian theory of the price of assets, the capital value of assets themselves. So he has a rental price theory, and then he has a price theory about the purchase price of assets. So you can rent a machine, or you could buy it outright, right? You could rent farmland or buy it outright. And what is the purchase price, the capital value, dependent upon? And Fetter correctly says, well, if the rental price depends upon the discounted marginal revenue product, the purchase price must be just the sum of the discounted marginal revenue products over the life of the asset. So again, this is just the standard view that you find in Rothbard or Mises. Okay, then we come to money. His view of money, as I suggested, was an attempt to apply subjective value theory to money. And he starts out, as most theorists do here, by giving us a topology. What are the different types of money? And he says, first of all, there's primary money. And by primary money, he means gold and silver coin. Fetter was a champion of the gold standard. And then he says the second type would be a money substitute. And these are mainly banknotes that are redeemable for specie. And then the third type he called political money. And he said political money is based upon legal tender or political power. So it comes into existence, or at least it's sustained by political power. And then he pointed out that in the market, the value of money will be based upon the marginal utility that it has in the different uses to which the monetary commodity can be put. You can see that this isn't quite right. He's not quite at the point that Mises reaches in 1912. He's saying something like this. The exchange value of money, its purchasing power, depends upon the value of gold in all of its alternative uses. It would be in other words, the value would be equated at the margin, or roughly equated at the margin. So it's a demand for gold in industry and in dentistry and so on and so forth that in part determines the marginal utility of gold and money, which it must conform to that marginal utility in dental work. So you can see this is kind of a roundabout way of arguing, right? This isn't quite right. In other words, if one applies the marginal utility theory to money, one must just say, what is the utility of money? How does the principle of diminishing marginal utility apply to money just as a good, right? You have to do it as an independent a piece of analysis. We wouldn't argue, for example, that the price of vanilla ice cream is determined by the price of chocolate ice cream. Right? We wouldn't say it that way. It might be influenced by it, but we wouldn't say that it's determined by it. Right? That's a different kind of claim. Okay, but he did have a very nice presentation of the dynamic process by which money's value changes. He said, let's imagine a case where the money stock goes up. He said, then the exchange value of money we know would go down because people would be holding excess money. They would be holding a surplus of money. They wouldn't want to initially hold this additional money, right? They'd want to spend it since they're already allocating their means in an optimal way. But as they spend the money, then they drive prices up. And it's the driving of the prices up that creates the conditions under which they're willing to hold the additional money. And this is the standard analysis you'll find in any Austrian work now. Okay, then just a couple of other theories of Fetter real quick. One is his theory of growth. He has the correct outlines of a theory of growth, that it's based upon capital accumulation. It depends upon the rate of saving and investing. That the rate of saving and investing depends upon people's time preferences. So for Fetter, the key to growth rates was the rate of time preference. Now, what Fetter lacked, though, and this is a crucial thing, because one might think that Fetter, because he had the correct theory of interest and he had a correct notion of capitalization and so on, he could have moved directly to the correct business cycle theory. What he lacked, though, was a full adoption of Bumbobwerk's idea of the capital structure. This is just missing in his book, and it's a major omission. It's a very unfortunate omission. He might have been able to achieve what Mises did in 1912, 8 years later, had he incorporated the notion of the capital structure into his work. Anyway, on his theory of the business cycle, then, he says the business cycle has three phases. There's a prosperity phase, there's a crisis phase, there's a depression phase. So that's good. That's a good start, right? That's an adequate initial description. We might say it has four phases today, but it's better than saying it's just boom-bust, right? The critical point that you have to explain in the boom-bust cycle is the crisis. The upper turning point. How do you explain how the boom goes to bust? So Fetter gives us an explanation. Anyway, he says the boom phase, the prosperity phase, is based upon monetary inflation and credit expansion. It leads to greater confidence. Entrepreneurs engage in all sorts of new ventures, or they start up old ones again. He points out that the extra profit that seems to be accruing in this process is partly illusory. It doesn't really, it's not realizable, we would say today. since it does exist nominally, entrepreneurs are earning more revenue and they're able to use this to bid the factors of production away from what turn out to be more valuable uses. And so we do get a malinvestment. We get mal or misallocation of the resources and malinvestment. So here too, he's pretty good. He lacks this intertemporal connection, right? He doesn't see that it's a distortion of the lengthening out of the structure of production, because he doesn't have the concept of the structure of production. Now, he says that the crisis comes when the monetary inflation and credit expansion that fuel the boom reverse, and the factor that reverses it is a specie outflow. This, by the way, was a fairly standard presentation of the business cycle theory, this idea, prior to Mises. So what happens is domestic prices start to go up, but exchange rates under a gold standard system are fixed or pegged, at least. And so the money becomes worth more overseas in international trade than it is domestically, and specie begins to flow out. As the specie flows out, well, the whole monetary inflation system begins to collapse, right? It's been built on fiduciary media and so on. The banks have to retrench now because they're losing their reserves. And so this is a fairly standard kind of account. This is not the Misesian account, right? This is just a particular case of a boom-bust cycle in the scheme of international trade. It depends upon the gold standard. If you did away with the gold standard, there'd be no reversing mechanism here. And so it's not a general theory. But he says the crisis is the forcible and sudden readjustment of mistaken capitalization. So again, he's got that part right. Right? This is a period of malinvestment. And then this all collapses on itself. And then last, let me mention his theory of entrepreneurship. He's very good on entrepreneurship. He calls the entrepreneur the enterpriser. He says that the enterpriser has the skill of judgment, foresight, as we would say. He can judge what will occur. He can accurately assess the future. He points out that different people have this skill in different degrees, and so in the market we naturally get a division of labor in entrepreneurship. The better ones who are able to do this earn profit and succeed, and those who are less able are washed out. So the entrepreneurs are subject to the competitive process. They're filtered through the market competitive process, and then they filter everything else, right? Because that's their job. They determine who gets hired into the various lines of activity, where capital gets invested, what land uses occur, and so on. Okay, now let's turn to Hazlitt. Hazlitt was born in Philadelphia in 1894 and passed away in 1993. His father died when he was 2, and his mother remarried and moved to Brooklyn when he was 9 years old. And unfortunately, it seems for him, or maybe fortunately for the movement, his stepfather died when he was 16. He entered into the College of the City of New York to study psychology, but because there was no major breadwinner in the family, he didn't have sufficient financing, and he dropped out. He took a job as a stenographer for the Wall Street Journal. That was his first job. I mean, he was just out of high school. And then he became, he showed great promise here. Hazlitt, too, was a tremendous intellectual, was a master of many subjects, and so he's naturally acclimated toward this kind of career. He became an editorial writer for the New York Evening Post in 1916. He did that for a few years. He moved to the the New York Evening Mail in the early 1920s. Became a literary critic for the New York Sun in 1925. And then became literary editor at The Nation. So he's moved up now into the, a top position, right? In 1930, he gets a job with The Nation. He stays there for 3 years, and he gets fired for writing anti-New Deal stuff. Very independent-minded and, he's like Fetter. He's a really good guy, high character kind of person who sticks by what he says regardless of the consequences for his material position. During this period, he met Benjamin Anderson and befriended. They became good friends. After he got fired, he was hired by Mencken at the American Mercury and served as editor for a year. And then he got a position as an editorial writer and book review author for the New York Times. It was very fortuitous. He took this position in 1934, and he was fired from that position, too, in 1946, because after Brenton Woods' agreement was signed in 45, he kept writing anti-Brenton Woods articles. And, they went in and they said, you got to quit this, Henry. You're a great guy. We'd like to keep you, but you can't, this is over. This battle's over. You got to stop. And he didn't stop. This is horrible. It's going to collapse, and everybody needs to know this. And so he got fired here, too. But it was during this time, you remember when Mises came to the United States, they immigrated in 1940, and Hazlitt got Mises his first paying job in the United States, writing ghostwriting editorials for the New York Times. A lot of the front page editorials, they're unsigned, were written by Mises if they're on economic topics. And so this is very important for me. He got paid. This paid fairly well, and was very helpful for Mises when he first came to the U.S. Well, after he was fired at the New York Times, he went to Newsweek in 1947. He stayed there until 1964. During that time, he was also co-editor of The Freeman, 1950 to 1953. Remember, this is the crucial period that Dr. Holtzman was talking about from his excerpts from his book his biography of Mises. This is a crucial time of where we almost built a Misesian movement, right? It got nipped in the bud, but so the Freeman was one of the main outlets for this. Okay, after the Newsweek, he was a columnist for a few years with the Los Angeles Times. But he continued to write, even after he retired, for the Freeman, Human Events, National Review, and so on, well into the 1980s. The estimates are that he wrote 10 million words. This is something like 150 volumes. It was tremendously prolific. And it was all sorts of different genres. He wrote a novel. He wrote a trilogy on literary criticism. He wrote two volumes in economics. He wrote a volume in moral philosophy. He was obviously a high intellect. He wrote two important book reviews. He reviewed socialism on January 9 in 1938 and sent this review to Mises. And they became friends via correspondence. And so when Mises, as I mentioned before, when Mises came to the U.S. in 1940, it was Hazlitt that met him, at the dock, right? They found him a place in New York and so on and so forth, got him the writing job with the New York Times. He introduced him to the people at Yale University Press. This, of course, gave him the opening to write his first two books in English, Bureaucracy and Omnipotent Government. It turns out from correspondence that we've discovered that these books needed tremendous editing. Mises didn't know English very well. He was, obviously a German speaker and French. He was fluent in French. He had reading knowledge of Italian, but his English was kind of a fourth language. He wasn't really well versed in English. And so when he first wrote Bureaucracy and Omnipotent Government, it was all a mess. Right? His syntax is terrible and the grammar and everything. And Hazlitt painstakingly went through it and edited it all. It was extremely helpful because, of course, if it hadn't been for the success of Bureaucracy and Omnipotent Government with Yale University Press, they wouldn't have gone with the project Human Action. In fact, they corresponded with Hazlitt, Yale Press corresponded with Hazlitt saying, should we really do this? Sure, he wants to write a 1,000-page treatise on economics, and look at all the trouble we had just getting out a 100-page book. But actually, interestingly, when Mises produced the first chapter, a sample chapter of Human Action, he produces a sample chapter and sends it to him and says, would you be interested? Hazlitt vetted it. He sent it to Hazlitt. Hazlitt read through it and he said, this is great. I don't need to change anything. It's great. So by the time we get to, say, 1946 or 47, Mises is now fluent in English. So good that, one of the great writers of the era is no longer considers it necessary to correct his work. The other book review he wrote is very important for the movement was of The Road to Serfdom. He published this in September of 1944. And it was important because it inspired the Reader's Digest version and really led to the popularity of, at least in America, of the book. Now, of course, Hazlitt's most famous are his Economics in One Lesson, his great book on economics in 1946. This is certainly a bestseller, one of the best-selling economics books of all time, well over 1 million copies. In fact, I believe that the only book that's ever sold more copies, the economics book that's ever sold more copies, is Samuelson's Economics. But of course, most of you know that the market for an economic textbook is a captured market, right? It's just a bunch of freshmen, college students who are buying it. So Hazlitt's book, just on actual demand for it, is probably even superior to Samuelson. Mises vetted this book. Hazlitt, of course, gives credit to Wixty, Bastiat, other Austrian luminaries, or fellow travelers at least. Remember, the main point of this book is that it's not just the immediate but long-run effects of policy that we must look at as economists, and that we must trace the consequences of policy not merely for one group but for all groups. This is the lesson. He also, as I mentioned earlier, wrote a lot of articles against Bretton Woods. These were collected into the book From Bretton Woods to World Inflation. It was published in 1984. Here he pointed out that Brentwood is just a pseudo gold standard. It has to end in inflation and collapse because of the linchpin of the system is the redemption of the dollar for gold, and as the Fed inflates, that that becomes untenable. His Newsweek columns that he was writing in the 1940s, late 40s and 50s, this is very interesting too. It shows you again Hazlitt's character. He was first writing in late 40s, calling for the repeal of the wartime interventions, you know, rolling back the war planning boards and price controls and so on. And this was not too controversial. There were a lot of other economists writing about this, but what Hazlitt then began to write for was the repeal of the New Deal. He said, okay, this is good, you know, good first step. We've gotten rid of all the war planning, but now we have to get rid of the New Deal. We get rid of all the labor legislation. We get rid of all the welfare programs and so on and so forth. And of course, the rest of history had passed him by on that. Right? Almost no one stood with him in journalism, in particular, on those particular ideas. He continued to call for restoration of the gold standard through this period. He attacked the welfare state. He wrote the great book, Will Dollars Save the World?, attacking the Marshall Plan. And so he was anti-internationalist to boot. after this, produced his great anti-Keynesian writings, The Failure of the New Economics in 1959, which is basically a line-by-line refutation of the general theory. And then The Critics of Keynesian Economics, 1960, a collection of anti-Keynesian articles, also quite powerful. Remember, this was before the heyday of Keynesianism, at least in America, right? This came in just with the Kennedy administration. So this is a preemptive strike, really, against Keynes. He wrote about the ethical foundations of capitalism and the foundations of morality, 1964. His last two books were attacks on the welfare state, Man versus the Welfare State in 1969, The Conquest of Poverty in 1973. Here, predicting very accurately the future state of welfare. In these books, he shows, in other words, the pathologies that welfare creates long before Bloom and, you know, these other modern works come along to say the same thing. Now, just real quickly, a few things about Benjamin Anderson. Anderson was born in Missouri, 1886. He also passed away in 49, same year that Fetter did. He did his bachelor's degree at the University of Missouri, went on to Illinois to get his master's degree in 1910, and received his PhD from Columbia in 1911. So again, he's a big shot, right? He gets a Columbia PhD. He taught for a year at Columbia, went to Harvard as an assistant professor in 1914. Stayed at Harvard for only 4 years. In other words, he didn't get tenured. He got kicked out. And then he went into banking. So he took a position at the National Bank of Commerce in 1918 and was editor of its publication, The Commercial Monthly. And then he became chief economist for Chase Manhattan Bank. And that was his big position. He stayed there from 1920 to 1939, and he was editor of the Chase Economic Bulletin during that period. And after his time there, he went back into academia. He took a professorship at UCLA for the last 10 years of his life. He, too, was a tremendous intellect. He wrote a primer on chess. He was a world-class chess player. It published in 1935. His first book was his dissertation called Social Value. And in this book is not particularly Austrian, and in the interest of time, I'll just skip over. He says some interesting things here, but I'll just skip over that. And go to his more important work for us, which is The Value of Money, that he published in 1917. This is what didn't get him tenure at Harvard. So most of this book is a refutation of the quantity theory of money. The title gives away what he's trying to do here, right? The value of money. He's trying to give an explanation for the value of money. He's trying to apply value theory to money, just like Mises did in 1912. So he goes through a long list. Again, we don't have time to go through this, but very similar to kinds of criticisms that Mises and other Austrians make of the quantity theory. He smashes all this, showing how it's all wrong. He shows how the monetarists have a misconception about the whole working of money. and points out that any kind of macroeconomic theory can't be aggregated. Again, a very Austrian position, right? It has to be a microeconomic theory. Now, here, though, I do want to point out one thing that he wrote that wasn't particularly Austrian. He didn't like the dual theory of value, right? The marginal utility, we say, applies to all goods and factors, but then the value of money is determined in this ad hoc way by the quantity theory. He thought this was a big mistake, right? You have to integrate these. This, again, was Mises's project. But he didn't think that Mises had done this. He didn't think that the theory of money and credit in 1912 had solved the problem of integrating marginal utility theory into money into it. He claimed that Mises' regression theorem was just a historical theory, that it didn't have any theoretical content to it, really. And he also held that marginal utility theory itself was circular. This is a somewhat strange claim, but he said marginal utility theory of price presupposes value. We value things, right? It presupposes money, and it presupposes a fixed or a known value for money. In other words, to set a preference between a good and money, we have to know both the value of the good that we set in our minds and the value of money. But in order to know the value of money, we have to know its purchasing power, right? Which is the prices of other goods. And so he claimed that this was, you know, that Mises hadn't solved the circularity problem here, and that the circularity problem could only be solved by postulating some external determination of the value of these things. And this is what he called the social value from his first book, that that you can only break this circularity by presupposing that there's something like a social, a value that's determined by individuals but becomes a social value, something like a commonly held position, like a conventional value of something. Like we say, football is a good sport or something like this. So we have some kind of conventional notion that this is so, a social notion of it. And then our individual valuations are affected by this, right? They're even determined, Davenport thought. Okay, so here again he's made a misstep, right? And Mises' theory, regression theorem, does in fact do what Mises claimed for it. It does show, in other words, that there is no circularity here, that what a person needs to know the value of money in order to set it against the value of the good in his preference rank is what he needs to be able to estimate it, is the value of money yesterday. And then he can trace the value, theoretically we can trace the value of money through history then back to its marginal utility. So, okay, well, his big book, his major work for the Austrians, though, is the Economics and the Public Welfare, which he published in 1949. This is his economic and financial history of America from 1914, right before the war, to 1946. And so he's got a devastating criticism of Keynes in this book, a chapter devoted to it that Hazlitt put into his Critics of Keynesian Economics. Very critical of Irving Fisher and the Monetarists on explaining the 1920s. He has a long and careful documentation of all the Fed inflation that occurred in this period. Lots of criticism of the New Deal and so on. So let me just briefly give you some of these details. He points out that he documents the huge monetary inflation of the First World War and concludes from this that it was only because of the Fed that America was able to effectively participate in the war. If we hadn't had a central bank, we would have been out. We couldn't have financed that level of participation. We would have just been a bit player in the war. Then he goes through the post-war boom. This monetary inflation set off a boom. He talks about the details of how the bust came and the liquidation. And he points out that basically there was a laissez-faire policy by the state. They basically just let things liquidate. And so the recession was over very quickly. He points out that though the Fed just reinflated very quickly, they didn't leave things alone, but began to reinflate. And so we were in a reinflation period from 1921 to 1923. And then interestingly, he says the New Deal began in 1924. This again is a very interesting position to take, right? He says it begins with raising of the tariff. So the New Deal is partly protectionist, right? It's a move toward economic autarky. So there's the raising of the tariff, monetary inflation, and credit expansion picks up in 1925, and so we get this really rapid inflation that begins in 25 and runs on to the stock market crash. He also points out that that the Fed did desperately try to reinflate after the crash came. So in the early 1930s, they were doing whatever they could to prevent the bankruptcies and liquidations. He criticizes Hoover. He's sort of a revisionist on Hoover, pointing out that he had all sorts of interventionist activities, trying to prop up wages, and this was leading to unemployment and so on. And he criticizes the U.S. for going off the gold standard. So that he calls this the New Deal first phase, 1924 to 1932. And then the second phase of the New Deal, he says, it was 33 to 39. And here he points out that he criticizes all the FDR's programs and so on. And then points out that the rally, the Great Depression was actually the severe downturn from 1930 to 32 or 33, and then a recovery. So the economy began to recover after 34 and 35, 36, 37, and then it went back into the tank in 37. And it's Anderson who claims that this this double dip recession, or the second depression phase, really came because of Supreme Court decisions, that the Supreme Court was striking down all these New Deal programs in 35 and 36 and so on. Then there was FDR's court packing scheme, and all of a sudden after 37 the court started to say, yeah, this is all fine, and passes constitutional muster, and this then sent business, rightfully changed their expectations about what would happen. And then the very last thing he talks about is World War II, where he says this was even worse than World War I. It permanently fastened these kinds of New Deal, state intervention policies on the economy. And that he also blames the Lend-Lease program for Bretton Woods. He says the Lend-Lease, because it was so heavily devoted to Great Britain, it's like $50 billion of Lend-Lease money, and $30 billion of it went to Great Britain, set off the disparities in currency. So this is what created the problems later that were to be solved by Bretton Woods, these wild swings in currencies that was supposed to be harnessed by the Bretton Woods Agreement. Well, I apologize for going a little bit too long, but I hope that was interesting. And I'd be glad to take up some questions if you want to come up and ask me.